Welcome to this special bonus episode of the Global Politico. We'll talk about a top of the agenda item for the new Trump administration, Israel and the United States, Donald Trump having his first meeting on Wednesday with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, their first face-to-face session. It's much anticipated, and now it comes right in the middle of basically the complete meltdown of President Trump's White House staff and national security team, totally in disarray after the unexpected forced resignation of his national security advisor, Michael Flynn. I'm joined for someone who's very well suited to discuss both of these topics, the NSC and Israel, Dan Shapiro. He was there through all 8 years of the Obama presidency. He's joining us by phone from Tel Aviv today. He was first President Obama's senior director at the National Security Council handling the Israel portfolio. Then he moved and became the U.S. ambassador there. He served for 5.5 years. He was the longest serving ambassador of the Obama years. Of course, he stepped down along with the entire rest of the diplomatic corps appointed by Obama on January 20th. There's nobody better to take us behind the scenes, not only in that very troubled at times relationship between President Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu, but also to help us understand what are the consequences of having a National Security Council in meltdown in the midst of this crucial moment for the U.S.-Israel relationship. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today. First of all, the last 24 hours have been head-snapping. What do you think about this meeting and about the National Security Council? What do you make of all this?
Thanks, Susan. It's great to be with you. Obviously, I'm as shocked as anybody and trying to keep up with the news, which seems to just unfold by the minute, about what is known about General Flynn's dealings with the Russian government, the Russian ambassador during the campaign and the transition, what was known by the Justice Department, what was known by various other members of the White House team, including the president. And I don't think this story is anywhere close to over. And that means to me that Prime Minister Netanyahu has arrived in Washington. He got there late yesterday at an absolutely crazy time to hold a meeting with the President of the United States. The White House staff is in complete turmoil. There's vicious backstabbing and infighting going on within the staff and finger pointing. There's a lot of indications that other heads are going to roll. A lot of questions are being raised about the president's own knowledge of the events that led to General Flynn's resignation. And so I'm putting myself back in the shoes of a NSC staffer, trying to imagine how are they going to prepare to conduct this meeting. General Flynn himself had met on at least 3 occasions with the director of the Mossad and the prime minister's national security advisor, who had come to Washington specifically to begin preparations for the two administrations to work together during the transition and since the inauguration. All that preparation is now out the window. It's hard to know who's even going to brief President Trump before the meeting in the Oval Office tomorrow. And NSC staff are going to be looking for guidance, but there's really nobody to provide it on what it is the president wants and needs. That means other players, maybe Jared Kushner, maybe Mr. Bannon, of course, Secretary Tillerson could have a role here. We don't know exactly how tied in he is with these White House meetings yet. But it's chaos. And if I'm Prime Minister Netanyahu, I'm very concerned that that chaos will, in the best situation, lead to a much less productive meeting, meaning decisions won't be able to be made, people will not be focused. And in the worst case, might take preparations that I thought I had achieved some understandings on with General Flynn and take them in a completely different direction because a new advisor suddenly has the ball.
You know, there's been so much expectation in Israel and here in the United States that Trump and Netanyahu would have this meeting of the minds, that there would be a complete reset in American policy toward Israel. What do you think is really driving that, and how much is this a bromance that's set up to fail?
Well, there were definitely statements made by President Trump and some of his advisors during the campaign that led some people in Israel and elsewhere to think that there wasn't going to be a complete sea change of U.S. policy on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, for example, and carte blanche for Israel to build settlements in the West Bank and the end of the pursuit of the two-state solution. There's a lot of excitement about that among members of Prime Minister Netanyahu's coalition to his right, members of his party and the Jewish Home Party to his right. But what we've seen already in the first 3 weeks of the administration have been not one but three statements by President Trump or others in the White House on his behalf stating that the pursuit of Middle East peace, which I think can only mean a two-state solution, is a priority. He's talked about it as the ultimate deal. He's assigned his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to pursue it, and that the expansion of settlements is problematic and not something he supports and makes it harder to achieve that goal. That is fully within the mainstream of U.S. policy on that issue for the last several decades. And it suggests to me that those are truly entrenched American interests, supporting Israel, supporting the pursuit of Israel's peace and security through a two-state solution, and opposing the construction of settlements. So the idea that there's going to be this massive sea change of U.S. policy on that issue, I think, is very much called into question. There are other areas where I suspect, again, if they can focus on the substance under these circumstances, the president and the prime minister will have an easy time reaching accord. I'm thinking about Iran, where both of them want to toughen up the international approach to Iran's ballistic missile program, perhaps impose new sanctions, perhaps also respond in a more forceful way to Iranian other provocations and the shipment of weapons to terrorist proxies, but probably do not, at least at this stage, want to tear up the Iran nuclear deal, because it would leave Iran with a free path to a nuclear weapon and no international support for sanctions. So I think they may find an agreement on that initial step with Iran. Where I think the events of this week and preceding them really raises a serious question about whether there's an alignment is on the issue of Syria. Because if President Trump is truly committed to a warmer and more cooperative relationship with Russia and with Vladimir Putin, the Russians are going to have some desires in Syria. They're going to desire U.S.-Russian joint operations against ISIL. They're going to desire some greater validation of the Russian presence in Syria and indeed of the permanence of the now stabilized Assad regime in Syria. That's not in Israel's strategic interest, because if Assad gains in Syria, Assad's allies, which are Iran and Hezbollah, are also going to gain in Syria. And the notion that President Trump is going to somehow manage to warm up with Syria, with Russia, including in Syria, and also split the Russians from their partner in supporting Assad, the Iranians, doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I think there's some rough waters ahead for the relationship on that specific question. Of course, it's all now taking place in the context where there's serious, serious questions being raised about the connections with Russia of many members of President Trump's team, including perhaps the president himself.
It's a doozy of a sentence anytime anybody says that, right? We're still all in just sort of jaw-dropping awe of this this particular moment we find ourselves in. But let's turn right now to this question, though, of the other side of the politics, which is, on the one hand, these public statements that suggest that Trump isn't rolling over and accommodating Netanyahu in a sort of dream scenario. The flip side is he's appointed a very pro-settlement U.S. ambassador to succeed you in that position, whose hearing is set to go forward in the Senate this week and who's expected to receive confirmation. He's indicated not that he's done with considering moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, but that he's still working on it. They haven't ruled it out. There's entirely a scenario where their public statements around settlements are helpful to Netanyahu rather than hurtful to him, in the sense that they help tamp down some of the pressure on his right wing. And of course, there's every indication that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, while being tasked with forging the undoable peace deal that has eluded so many other presidents, at the same time also comes from a family and has his own history of being very supportive of the right wing of Israeli politics. So, you know, what do you make of those kind of countervailing trends? And just the other day, there was Sheldon Adelson, of course, a key backer of both Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, jawboning with the president and his team?
Yeah, well, there's a lot there to unpack. I mean, one thing it suggests is that the president is hearing from different camps of advisors who have different views. Some who have openly called into question or even said there's no reason for the United States to support a two-state solution anymore and to change our policy on West Bank settlements. Others who clearly continue to support that and believe that's in the U.S. national interest. He's got a Secretary of State, comes from the energy industry, obviously has dealt with Arab governments in the past, has never really dealt with Israel. We'll see how that impacts his views. A Secretary of Defense, who served as the commander of CENTCOM and so knows the Arab governments well and has spoken about the way the sort of festering Israeli-Palestinian conflict affects U.S. Security interests and relationships elsewhere in the region. I think the president himself has indicated on several occasions now that it's not clear exactly how much depth he has on the issue or how much thought he's given to it, but that he believes there's a deal to be had and he wants to be the deal maker, the ultimate deal maker. The fact that he would invest somebody very close to him, Jared Kushner, who may be new to the issues, may not have worked on this as a diplomat before, but you know, if he's talking to the right people and is known to have the confidence and be able to speak on behalf of the president, you know, people will take him seriously. There's a lot of indication that he is serious about wanting to do this. The statements on settlements, indeed, may well be either coordinated with or in some ways signed off on by Netanyahu, who always relied on President Obama as sort of an excuse to go to his right-wing coalition partners and say, gee, I'd like to do even more settlement construction, but we're under so much pressure from the United States. The notion that the United States wouldn't put any pressure on him actually puts more pressure on him because of the rivals in his coalition on his right. One thing that's interesting, and I think also affects this approach on settlements and perhaps going slow on the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem, is an idea that Prime Minister Netanyahu is actually bringing to this meeting, which is, why don't we try, instead of another fruitless attempt at Israeli-Palestinian negotiations when the trust is low and the gaps are wide, why don't we try to warm up Israel's relations with the Sunni Arab states, with whom it really has an alignment of interests. Everyone in those states and Israel are poised against the same threats and enemies in the region, Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, ISIL, Muslim Brotherhood. And so there's already a lot of quiet, and in some cases more overt, in the cases of Egypt and Jordan, security cooperation between Israel and those countries. So the idea is that if you could warm up those relationships, show some signs of normalization by Arab states toward Israel that would show the Israeli public they have a prospect of kind of integration and being welcomed into the neighborhood, that would lubricate eventual return to Israeli-Palestinian talks, and maybe the Arabs would be even more invested in seeing them succeed. But if you're going to ask Arab governments to take those kinds of steps, it doesn't stand to reason that you can at the same time ask them to endure things that are very difficult for them, like major settlement announcements or perhaps the move of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. King Abdullah of Jordan was very shrewd, and he hustled over to Washington in the first week of the administration without an invitation for the National Prayer Breakfast, but he managed to get an audience with first Vice President Pence and then President Trump. And the accounts of those conversations were that he was very, very clever and careful and shrewd in arguing the case that I'm your friend, I'm your partner, I want to help you succeed in the region, including perhaps on this what's called the outside-in approach of Israel and Arab states before Israel and the Palestinians. But there are certain things that would make my life much harder, and please take those into account when you make those decisions.
Dan, I can't think of anyone else who has had a more front row seat over almost the entire span of the last 8 years for this fascinating, interesting, provocative, troublesome, and at times difficult relationship between Barack Obama and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu than you. So, you're a liberated man these days. You've taken to Twitter with a zeal that might surprise even some of your former diplomatic colleagues. What was it like having a front row seat over these last almost 7 years, right?
So I spent probably as much time with the prime minister as any U.S. official Certainly, I was the only, I think, person on the U.S. side present for all of the Prime Minister and the President, President Obama's meetings in Washington, in New York, at the UN, and here in Israel. And so I have a, I definitely had a front row view of their relationship. And, you know, there's, it's basically been a soap opera as described in the public discourse, that these were two leaders who got on each other's nerves, who came from some kind of a different ideological backgrounds, one maybe right of center, one left of center, who had conflicting personalities and visions about the right way to achieve even goals that they may have shared. And look, I would be less than honest if I didn't say there was some truth in all of that. And there were definitely difficult moments, some of them very public, some of them the kinds that make ambassadors very uncomfortable, because we are just supposed to be solving problems in quiet diplomacy. And sometimes the disagreements would spill out onto the public discourse, and I'm happy to talk about any of them, so I don't pretend or deny they existed. At the same time, and I really think this is an important point, President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu accomplished a great deal together that strengthened the U.S.-Israel relationship, and I think advanced both of our countries' interests. They together significantly upgraded U.S.-Israel strategic and security cooperation in intelligence sharing, in missile defense, in other technologies, in joint training of our militaries, in signing a $38 billion memorandum of understanding for future military assistance. They helped together navigate the very difficult months and years of the Arab Spring, or the transitions in the Arab world that created instabilities that threatened Israel. They worked together on things like getting chemical weapons out of Syria. Israel is a contributor in intelligence to the counter-ISIL campaign. Even Iran, which was the source of such disagreement, derived from a lot of a lot of agreement on the goal of preventing an Iranian nuclear weapon, and at least for the first 4 or 5 years, building and enforcing a sanctions regime that put Iran under great pressure was something they worked on together. So I do think that when historians look at the period of their relationship at some remove from the day-to-day political and media swirl, they will get more credit than they maybe do at the moment for the things they achieved together that strengthened the relationship and advanced the interests of both countries, which in no way suggests that they didn't also have these various serious disagreements.
Well, you called it a soap opera, and you know, I was just reflecting on the fact that soap operas are all about narratives, right? And the story that we fundamentally have absorbed, right, about Netanyahu and Obama is basically a personal story, which is why it's more the nature of a soap opera. These are two leaders whose countries are linked in very important and fundamental ways in a partnership, but at the same time had two leaders who, through chemistry, politics, ideology, whatever it was, didn't connect at that personal level in the same way. Although you made a great point to me at some point when we talked before, which is that their disagreements were more in the nature of they seemed to get along well when they would have meetings, but then immediately afterwards something would happen or it would get interpreted in a different way. Is that a fair assessment of how it worked?
That's absolutely fair. Every meeting they had was conducted in a very professional, I would say even cordial, and at times downright friendly manner. It was not that they never had even moments in their private discussions where they had a disagreement. Some of their phone calls were a little bit testier at certain key junctures, like around the time that the Iran deal was emerging, first from the Lausanne understandings in April of 2015, and then when the deal was actually signed in July. So the phone calls, depending on what was happening, could be a little testier. The meetings themselves, I have to say, always looked to me like two leaders who actually were able to come at these questions in a professional way, trying to advance their nation's interests as they understand them, frequently seeing significant overlap in what we each were trying to achieve or how we each defined our interests. And where there was disagreement, talking about it very openly, very candidly, leading to future work by their subordinates and by their diplomats and others to try to sort out and try to get on get more on the same page. But it was not the case that they were kind of they get in the room and they start screaming at each other or throwing things at each other. Now by the end, after a very very tough year of 2015 with the Iran deal, the Prime Minister's speech in Congress, the battle all the way through that year. You know, I'm not sure either of them was all that eager to spend a lot of time together. But, you know, they met again in November following the end of the congressional review of the Iran deal, actually charted a very productive course for 2016 on the MOU negotiations, on enabling on enforcement and compliance with the Iran deal, on enabling Israel to sort of manage its needs and security requirements in Syria in coordination with us as we were dealing with the Russians and pursuing the ISIL campaign. They then met again, I guess, at the UN in the fall just last year, and then briefly saw each other at the funeral of President Shimon Peres in Israel. So those were their kind of last face-to-face encounters, and I'm not sure either of them was nagging the staff to get them, you know, lots more FaceTime with one another. But again, all the work was done, carried out in a professional and a cordial manner.
Well, you know, it's interesting you point out that their last face-to-face encounter was at the Shimon Peres funeral. Both you and I were there, and that was an incredible moment. I mean, it's symbolic, even if not intentionally so, right, that Obama took time out. This was this fall. Shimon Peres, the longtime leader of Israel, of course, rival, political rival of Netanyahu to the very end, Peres was the architect of what never turned out to be a plan for the two-state solution, whereas Netanyahu never was able to move forward on peace talks. And many people saw at that funeral almost a funeral for the very concept of a two-state solution, for the very concept of the kind of peace outlined in the Oslo Accords under the Peres government. Obama came and talked very personally. It was a very emotional speech by him. In many ways, the Americans, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, seemed more emotional about the loss of this last kind of founding generation leader of Israel than Netanyahu and his right-wing coalition did. So it's kind of symbolic in a way, isn't it, that was their last encounter?
Partly that was derived from President Obama's very close personal friendship with President Peres, which was really quite amazing. To see these two people from such different backgrounds and such different generations and experiences nevertheless find this bond. I had seen President Obama in New York at the UN and told him about President Peres' condition and that we didn't know the future, but there could be a funeral in the near term. And he said to me with no hesitation, if I can be there, if there's a funeral, I will be there. I would do that for Shimon. And when he came, there wasn't a lot of time on the ground for political meetings. He was there focused on being with the family and then that speech, which was not just a personal reflection and eulogy to a good friend with all the amazing history that the two of them each represent, but in many ways a personal testimony about his belief and faith in, let's call it, the liberal Zionist vision, Israel as a nation that's striving for peace with its neighbors, that is a light to the nations, that is proud and secure and fulfilling the vision of generations of Jews and the Zionist pioneers who built the country like Shimon Peres. So many Israelis came up to me after that speech, including some right of center Israelis who may not have agreed with every aspect of his policy, and said, wow, if only we had a leader in Israel who could deliver a speech of defense of liberal Zionist values as well as President Obama did, then maybe we'd be getting somewhere.
Well, you know, you are sort of a student, obviously, of Netanyahu. You've watched him over the last 8 years, not only in how he's dealt with Obama, but just in terms of as a politician, as a man. My guess is the Trump White House has not called you for a briefing But if they did,
That's correct.
What would you what would you tell them in terms of preparing for that really important face-to-face encounter between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu? What's the briefing on Bibi and how he should handle that?
Well, he's look. He is clearly a deeply patriotic person who has spent his whole life working to advance his country's interests, and he defines them largely in security terms. So let's say security and existence terms. He really believes fundamentally that Israel is constantly fighting for its existence. While it's a strong country and actually getting stronger economically, and maybe in juxtaposition with the chaos in much of the rest of the region, it's thriving. But he sees threats around every corner. He certainly defines Iran as the great existential threat to the state of Israel, and believes that Iran still wishes to achieve a nuclear weapon and potentially use that nuclear weapon to destroy the state of Israel, and that that will be his priority above everything else. He will want to chart a course with President Trump to significantly toughen the international posture toward Iran. Whether that includes actually canceling the Iran deal at the beginning, I have my doubts about. I think the Israeli security leadership really understands that the deal has achieved what it was intended to by putting the Iran nuclear program way, way out several more years. That's a valuable time for them to build up their own defenses. That's valuable time to gather intelligence. And as long as it's being enforced and Iran is not cheating, they are better served by having that deal in place, at least for the next few years, and maybe dealing with it as an endgame matter in the latter years. So I think the toughening may be around other issues like Iran's ballistic missile program, perhaps some new sanctions because of the testing of those programs, perhaps some toughening rhetoric and action regarding Iran's other provocative behaviors, harassing ships, sending weapons to various proxies, involvement in Syria, that those might be areas where he would seek and probably be able to get the Trump administration to work with him. At the same time, he's a very he's a canny politician, but a politician who's always got his always looking over his shoulder, and he should in the Israeli political system. It's quite cutthroat. It depends on sustaining a coalition of very diverse parties through all kinds of ups and downs. He doesn't always know that he can count even on the members of his own party, much less his coalition partners, to stand with him. He's also facing some challenges of some police investigations of corruption charges against him and his family. So he will never want to take an action that really puts him in significant political jeopardy unless he has kind of really thought it all the way through and knows he has strong backing from Washington and can use that to kind of keep his various coalition partners in line. So he looks for close coordinators with Washington, what they used to tell us they would call tailwind, where if he will propose, I'm going to do certain steps to open up Palestinian economic activity in the West Bank, but I'm not making any promises about where that leads, I'm going to restrict my building and settlements to the settlement blocks close to Israel, but I'll do less distant from Israel. I'm trying to open up channels of communication with Arab nations, Sunni Arab governments that believe Israel is a strategic partner on Iran and on ISIL and don't care as much about the Palestinian issue. He will look for Washington backing for a strategy like that so that if he follows it and he gets in trouble, politically, he can fall back on that this was a well-coordinated diplomatic initiative that was done with Washington.
In the spirit of an after-action report or the advice perhaps that the Trump team hasn't yet gotten around to asking you, if there was one thing that you could have as a do-over between Obama and Netanyahu, what would it be?
Well, there's not just one thing, look, There's one thing, obviously, that I think was a very significant step taken from the Israeli side that I think had long-lasting implications, and that was the decision to speak in Congress. Not just the decision to speak in Congress, but the way that decision was reached and announced, which was really done without any coordination with us. And that was very unfortunate. And it not only, actually, in some ways, I think it made it easier for the president to actually gain congressional approval of the Iran deal. It made it a much more partisan issue and made Democrats much more likely to back him because of the way the speech had been arranged just with the Republican leadership of Congress and no consultation with the administration. But it definitely had a long-lasting kind of coarsening of people's emotions about the relationship, and it even started to affect us in other areas. I think we were able to recover from it and do some very good work, including like signing the MOU near the end on security assistance, but it made for rough sailing. I'm sure the Israelis would point to ways we conducted, aspects of a way we conducted the negotiations, and they didn't always feel they knew everything that was going on, and maybe they would put the finger at us. But I think our coordination broke down in that period in a way that was unfortunate. The only other thing I would maybe do differently, you know, when I was constantly faced with the challenge of President Obama's sort of personal reputation and standing in Israel. Lots of people, you know, didn't think he was that friendly. Of course, I believe they were very wrong, and I was happy to tell them that. Periodically, people would contrast me with him, say, well, we like you, you're friendly, but we don't like your president. I said, I'm sorry, that doesn't work. I represent him. He validates me. I don't validate him. And what was interesting was that when he came here to visit in 2013, early in the second term, and he was here for about 3 days, and he was absolutely at the top of his game, incredibly charming and articulate. He gave just a brilliant speech to a group of Israeli students. He and the prime minister were warm and had good chemistry. They were launching the new peace negotiations that Secretary Kerry led. They charted a course at that time that we were working very closely together on Iran sanctions. And many, many Israelis, having watched that visit over 3 days, and it was all on, you know, live television minute by minute, came up to me afterward and said, you know what, I can see that he's a friend. I may disagree with him on this or that policy, but I can see he's motivated by our best interest, and he cares about us. He cares about our security, which is the ultimate test for most Israelis. Do you get their sense, their sense of insecurity and vulnerability? And if you have that, you can have tough conversations as a friend. I thought, wow, we really turned the corner. This is great. But it didn't have the lasting effect. If I could have had him come visit every 3 months, I would have happily done so. When Israelis got to see him up close, I think that's how they responded to him. So maybe an earlier visit, there were some opportunities to visit. I don't think it was a mistake to not come here right after the Cairo speech, but we probably could have looked for an opportunity much earlier than we did that could have helped establish that sense that Israelis had that there will be disagreements, but at the same time, you have a real friend in the White House, someone who's really committed to this relationship and your security. I know the policy record bears that out, and I think fair-minded people will acknowledge that. But it was, you know, we had our ups and downs reminding people of that during some of these periods of disagreement.
Well, that's such a great example, Dan. I think, you know, this the power of personal diplomacy, especially when practiced by somebody like President Obama, it's getting on the schedule, right, that is the biggest challenge for an ambassador. But this has been a great conversation. I have to say, I feel like we're all listening to the first draft of history here as written by you. I hope you will sit down and write it all down for us, and we're very grateful.
I guess the first draft is written on Twitter now, but maybe I'll try to write something longer than 140 characters.
Dan, when I was editor of Foreign Policy, we ran a cover story once by someone you know well, Aaron Miller, and he wrote about his efforts, unsuccessful efforts to try to help U.S. presidents forge a peace deal in Israel and Palestine. And I believe the title was, you know, Middle East Peace Was My Religion. I'm an atheist now. you've spent as much time, perhaps, as almost anybody, except for Aaron Miller and maybe Dennis Ross, trying to work on a peace deal with successive American leaders. Are you a believer?
Well, I believe it's still very much a U.S. interest, and so I believe we have every reason to continue to try to achieve it. I believe it's in Israel's interest. It's still the majority of Israelis, and even this prime minister from the right side of Israel's spectrum, say that for Israel to remain a Jewish and democratic state, which is the sort of the vision of its founders, and achieve security and prosperity and success with its neighbors, it's going to take that painful but nevertheless necessary division of the land into two states. And of course, that requires a partner. And the Palestinians have often not stepped up to the plate the way they need to. So there are plenty of reasons why all these past negotiators, myself included, have been frustrated by this effort. I do believe it's getting harder. I believe that each failure of negotiation breeds its own wave of despair and disillusionment on the populations of both sides. We've now had 8 years of the Netanyahu-Abbas dynamic, two leaders who just don't trust each other and have never really invested in each other as partners and made it easier for the other one to make the hard decisions. We sometimes saw that in earlier eras between Israeli and Palestinian or Israeli and other Arab leaders where they really projected to the public that they were partners in a common enterprise. We haven't had that. We have publics who are very disillusioned as well. While we're still polling still shows on both sides majorities want to achieve two states, mostly the same majorities say they don't expect it to happen, and they mostly blame the other side. Israelis point to violence and terror and incitement and educating Palestinian children to hate and to glorify those who have used violence. Palestinians point to an entrenched occupation and continued expansion of Israeli settlements. And both sides have a perfect narrative that says we want the two-state solution, but the other side doesn't. I don't know where the tipping point is, where it becomes impossible. Now, that's the thing about tipping points, is that sometimes you don't know you're past them until you're well past them. And so it's possible we'll look back and say, you know, it was in this decade that it really became impossible to actually unwind things and create a viable two-state solution. I certainly hope that's not the case. I would certainly believe that it's in our interest, and I hope, you know, this administration will make it a priority and continue to work on it. But it's not getting easier, and I don't know how much more time it will still be a viable project to pursue.
So if the peace process is a religion, it's one with a big crisis of faith attendant in it these days.
I guess all of us who go to that synagogue or church are also skeptics at the same time.
So Dan Shapiro, I think, has been probably one of my best guides now that he's publicly unleashed and out there on Twitter to this unfolding and very important U.S.-Israel relationship. You can follow him, by the way, on Twitter at Daniel B. Shapiro. And he's already, in just a couple of weeks, become famous for his tweet storms. They're not tweet storms about crazy celebrity stuff. They're tweet storms about wonky policy issues, but nonetheless, I think he's been a fantastic public guide to what's happening. And as we see Trump and Netanyahu emerge, I'm sure you'll have lots of fascinating play-by-play commentary. If there was one thing that we should listen for coming out of that meeting, what would it be?
I'm going to say two things, actually. One is the prime minister. Well, can I restart that answer?
Yes, please.
I'm going to say two things, and I expect the meeting to be warm and friendly, and to project that publicly. And I expect that to be genuine, and that's a good thing. I'm a big believer in the importance of good relationships between Israeli and American leaders. I say that with all due knowledge of some of the things that transpired in the Obama administration. But I do think President Trump may be probing Prime Minister Netanyahu for his bottom line. What's his real bottom line? The prime minister has, since 2009, endorsed the idea of two states for two peoples. He gave a famous speech at Bar-Ilan University in which he described that vision that was new for him. He had never endorsed a Palestinian state before that. He has stuck by that vision and that slogan. The details are complicated because his vision of a Palestinian state and Palestinians' visions may not fully match up, but at least at the level of the principle, that remains his bottom line, or has. But he left Israel this week with many members of his own government, many members of his own party, telling him that's history. That's over. You don't need to support a Palestinian state anymore. We oppose it, his members of his own party and government. President Trump isn't going to push you on it, so there's no reason for you to make that concession. And it's time to push for other things, annexation of various parts of the West Bank, unrestricted settlement construction, legalization of settlements that were built on Palestinian privately owned land. And so he's facing those pressures, and I think he will come and still stick to his two states for two peoples program. But if the president is pushing him, help me understand your bottom line so that I know what I have to work with as I send my son-in-law out to try to create the ultimate deal. The prime minister may be in a political situation at home where he is reluctant to get into a lot of specifics about what that bottom line looks like. That's one area. The other area is, as I mentioned, Syria and Russia. There are so many question marks about what this administration's real approach is going to be on Russia. And of course, you don't hear the same things from some of the cabinet members that you hear from the president. But the president's been fairly consistent that he wants a warm relationship with Russia, that he believes he and Putin can be partners. And Russia and Israel actually have a kind of functional mutually respectful relationship in terms of Israel safeguarding its interests in southern Syria. But Israel's under no illusions. Russia being a permanent, heavily armed presence in the region is not good for Israel's interests. Russia's friends in the Middle East are not Israel's friends, whether that's Iran, whether that's Hezbollah, whether that's Assad. And so if the Trump vision includes concessions to Russia in the Middle East, perhaps so there will be a joint U.S.-Russian effort against ISIL, but at the expense of strengthening other enemies of Israel who are friends of Russia in the region, I think that could be a point of real tension coming out of this meeting.
Dan Shapiro in Tel Aviv, our former ambassador, a wise and on-point observer of the U.S.-Israel relationship in all of its many interesting and at times dysfunctional facets. Thank you so much for being with us today on this special bonus edition of the Global Politico. I'm Susan Glasser. I hope that you will subscribe to the podcast, rate us, go to iTunes, spread the word among your friends. Email me at sglasser@politico.com. I'd love your ideas, thoughts, feedback. Thanks again.
Thanks, Susan.
Thanks, Dan.